Today I'm talking to Captain Peter Simpson. Born and bred in Scarborough, Peter was taught his seamanship at the Graham Sea Training School at Scarborough, and from there served a long and distinguished maritime career, including, would you believe, several years involved in shipbuilding, which I certainly want to know more about. Firstly, Peter, please tell me how, at the young age of 16 and with no history of seafaring in the family, you became a seaman.
Well, as a young chap, I was still at school at the Graham Sea Training School, fast approaching my 16th birthday, at which time I hadn't quite made up my mind what I wanted to do. I either wanted to go in the Merchant Navy and take up a training there in the form of an apprenticeship, deck apprentice, and also I was considering going into the Royal Navy. However, things moved along fairly quickly, and the headmaster of the school called me in one day into his study. And he said, "How would you like to go into the Merchant Navy as an apprentice?" I said, "Well, that's probably the top answer on my list too. That's what I was going to consider doing." It happened in this way that he said, "Well, I've got in front of me an application form for a company called Ships Finance and Management Company, who was a London Greek outfit, but looking for cadets and apprentices who they could train up to operate and manage their ships." So I said, "Well, I would be quite happy to join them," not knowing anything about them, not really caring, just wanting to get away to sea and get on with my start of my career anyway. I was 16 years of age and I got a letter from them offering me a place on one of their ships as a cadet or as an apprentice, as we were called in those days. And after signing my apprenticeship papers, I signed on and went to my first ship in June 1953 as an apprentice. I had to serve 4 years with this particular company and see how I got on. And at the end of that time, my career would then be decided.
So here you were, age 16, with your apprenticeship under your belt and on your first voyage to Syria, I believe, in July 1953. Describe what life was like for you for the early part of your career.
A bit rough, and I don't mean the sea. I mean the conditions were a little bit rough. My first ship was an oil tanker. I did not intend to go to sea on an oil tanker. I wanted cargo vessel work, but this was the first opportunity for me to go, and I accepted the appointment. When I say it was a bit rough, because I was an apprentice, I had to learn and learn fast. So you start at the bottom and you work your way up to the top. And I was under the control of the bosun on deck, who used to send me down into the bilges of the oil tank to clean out all the sludge, fill the dirty buckets with the sludge. And then myself and the other apprentice who was there used to haul these buckets up by hand, tip them into a larger barrel. And when these barrels were full, we used to roll them down the deck and store them until we got to a port where they would accept them as sludge. And we never ever once threw them overboard into the sea, I might add. They had to be disposed of in a proper and likewise seamanlike condition. So this is how I started my career. I thought I was going to trot around in whites or a uniform all day long. I spent most of my 24 hours a day in a boiler suit that was cleaned every day and made ready for the next job down the tanks.
And where in those days were you travelling in the world?
Well, it was on a backwards and forwards sort of route. We started out, as you rightly pointed out, by going to Syria, a little place called Banias, B-A-N-I-A-S, in Syria, which was an oil port. But it was oil port insofar as you was anchored 1 mile offshore and you picked up connecting oil pipelines from the seabed. These were buoyed and marked. You put your stern on, anchors down and stern to the coast, then picked up the oil pipelines, secured them to the vessel as was required, and then the pumping started and we were pumping their oil into our tanks. This was out of my realm at that time. I was only a young fellow and I just did as I was told. I didn't have much of a clue as to what was actually going on then, but this was what I had to do most of the time when we were approaching ports.
And how much time did you have in between voyages?
Well, in between voyages, I did quite well. Initially, I used to get about 5 to 6 weeks between voyages, but a lot of the time, particularly that first vessel I was on, which was called Lord Canning, the leave was limited. Even though you arrived back in the UK, you were not expected to be home for more than a week or 10 days. In those days, when I was a young fellow, I didn't care too much about that. I just wanted to get on with my apprenticeship. So I was inclined to re-sign on the same vessel for a while, backwards and forwards, running to either Banias or further afield to the Persian Gulf, Mina al-Hakhmadi, where we again loaded oil back for Europe. So we used to get to Europe, Europort, Hamburg, UK occasionally, the Isle of Grain, places like that where there was storage facilities for oil.
So in those early days, with the signing on the same ship, going backwards and forwards, I get the impression that there wasn't much time that you were able to spend with your family. How did you ever have time also to develop a social life?
Well, you make friends on board, of course. There was one seaman in particular who was a very experienced chappie from the islands of Scotland, who took me under his wing in many ways and showed me the ropes, and I used to follow him around. And then when we knocked off at the end of the working day, I would sit and we would talk about things seaman-like, and he would pass a lot of his information on to me. It was quite interesting insofar as, you know, I think I learnt an awful lot from this fellow. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. Now, he was the start of me really digging deeper into a seafaring career, and he introduced me to many other aspects of seafaring that were good for me in a future that I didn't foresee at that time. When I came ashore, when I actually came home on leave, I used to go around with a bunch of lads, backwards, forwards, into the pubs, out of the pubs, and occasional other little things. It wasn't until much later that I met my wife there. I was home on leave, and it's going to be an amusing episode here, insofar as I went into a pub one night with my friends, four or five of us, some of them who are still friends, and I went to sit down next to a couple who I didn't know, but there was a vacant seat there when I'd got my pint of beer. So I sat down next to this couple and started talking to them, got to know them a little bit, and then suddenly this very elderly chap came into the pub, looked at me and said, "That's my seat you're sitting in," and immediately vacated the seat and sat down. And after a week or so, we were in the same pub, my pals and I, and the same people were in there, so I went over to say hello to them. It turned out that they were the mother and father of my future wife, and I got talking to them, and they said, "Well, we'll bring you our daughter. Well, our daughter might like to have a little chat with you." So I said, "Well, I'll be here next week," and that's it. She came into the pub. Her parents went home and told her this seafaring chappie was wishing to meet her, which is not exactly true. I mean, I just said, "Yes, of course, if you bring your daughter, I'll say hello to her." And she came, and we got on from that moment. And I think that was the start of a long and prosperous sort of agreement between us. I went away to sea and she stayed at home. It was good and bad because halfway through a particular voyage, she said she no longer wanted to see me. I was away too long. Things would have to change a little bit. And I said, "Well, being stubborn, I have made my career at sea and I really must follow that through. If at the end of the day you can't see your way clear to accept that, it looks like the parting of the ways." Anyway, we discussed it thoroughly, deeply, and decided we would give it a bash. Here we are 50 years later still together, so it must have been the right decision.
So going back to sea then, tell us how you progressed to being a master mariner and then taking charge of your first ship as captain.
Okay, I'll start at the very beginning there and say that during the course of my four-year apprenticeship, I'd like to think that I was showing signs of intelligence and advancement, learning as I went along. And so I was taken on one of the cargo vessels that I served upon as an uncertificated third mate. Now, I couldn't break my apprenticeship. I was still only 19 years of age, and I was given control of the watch-keeping agenda for the 8 to 12 watch on the vessel under the instructions of the master of the vessel. In other words, I was keeping watch, but he was doing the navigating. And if anything ever showed up on the horizon or out at sea, it would be his responsibility and not mine to do whatever was correct. But I was understudying him from that point on. So I spent 2 years of my apprenticeship doing this understudying. At the end of the time, the best job that they could offer me, that particular company, Ships Finance and Management Company, was a standby job as third officer on a laid-up ship, not knowing when the next employment would be. So I said, well, that's no use to me, and I've got to look elsewhere. So my first thoughts were, right, I will get myself to college. And I went to the Boulevard Nautical College Hull, where I did a lot of training, further training, insofar as it was educational in getting my second mate certificate. I got my second mate certificate after 6 months of trying, went away to sea again, this time as a certificated officer and in charge of the 8 to 12 watch. That went on for a couple of years. And then I was back home again as a 24-year-old, shall we say. And I went again to Boulevard Nautical College, where I sat my chief officer certificate. Having achieved that, I thought, well, I will have to do something here. I'm going to stay at sea. So meanwhile, I'd applied to Andrew Weir Shipping Company, because after 6 months ashore and the end of an apprenticeship, which wasn't paying any more than 10 shillings a month, I was in the position where I was hard up, extremely hard up. I'd borrowed some money and I had to pay that money back. And so I went to sea with a shipping company that was going to keep me away at sea for 2 years and give me a reasonable salary and give me an opportunity to make my way in life. So I joined Andrew Weir Shipping Company, went away for a 2-year voyage, never came home in that 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, I said that I was prepared to stay on and do another 2 years. So they said, no, we can't have that. If you're staying with us and wish to stay with us, then what you should do is get yourself home at the end of this voyage, which we're on now. And when you've done your 2 years, go home, get back to Boulevard Nautical College and get your master's certificate. When you've done that, then come back to us, and we will advance you along the line. So that is exactly what happened, and I went away to sea, eventually as a chief officer, and carried on there until the day I was promoted as master.
I'm guessing over that time, there were some good times, but also some difficult and sad times.
Yeah, the good times all came when I was younger, simply because I was experiencing life. I made friends with a lot of people on my first Andrew Weir ship, and this was good grounding. In effect, we used to go out as a gang together. Seafarers do have a tendency to do that. If you can get 3 or 4 or 5 people together who are not on duty and have a bit of spare time, you'll find they all go out together. It's not from pub to pub, as so many people seem to think, but this was taken up by going exploring around a town or city, often visiting churches, often visiting other kinds of libraries were very good places. There was always something on, and in particular, seafarers' missions, which was called the Missions to Seamen. There was always something going on at these places. They arranged dances, they arranged coffee mornings, they arranged for you to go there and make telephone calls home, and all things like that. So everybody made their way there at some stage or another, and these places were just about to be found in most good ports around the world anyway. The bad times, unfortunately, they do come along. Most of them happened to me a little later because of the fact that I was never involved in being a senior officer at that time. I was always one of the gang, shall we say. I had an unfortunate incident when I just got my first job as chief officer, insofar as the master died at sea and I had to take over the responsibilities of the master. As a 26-year-old, not knowing an awful lot other than what I'd been taught ashore, thrown in at the deep end, so to speak. The master, unfortunately, had a heart attack in Madras. He was landed ashore, and I was told the ship must go on, and you will now be acting master until you can be replaced. You will then go back to being chief officer, but for the moment you are the master of the vessel. I had the qualifications, I didn't have the experience. That was one sad time. Later in life, when I was more experienced, I had the unfortunate experience of having a man fall down the hold, a 30-foot drop from the deck to the bottom of the hold, which was empty at the time. He was involved in closing the hatch up and he slipped and fell. And this was somewhere off South Australia. And we had to pull into Perth, or Fremantle, actually. This is the port for Perth. And he died en route, and we had to land his body ashore there. And there was an inquest that I had to attend, and not very pleasant. Then after that, I was involved in my first little venture of shipbuilding. When I went to Belfast to join a ship called the Nairn Bank, that was completing its building. It was 3/4 of the way to being built by this time.
And what was your role in
that? My role was supervising various fitments that were going on board. As chief officer, as I was then, I had to see that all the cargo spaces were properly decked out, that all the equipment was working on the bridge, that we were getting the quality of the goods that we had asked for, things like that.
And how many years were you involved in that?
And I was involved in that little bit of shipbuilding for about 8 months. I then went back to sea again, and a couple of trips later, we had an unfortunate incident whereby I was still chief officer at this time. I went back to sea as chief officer, and we had an unfortunate incident in the South Pacific where we ran aground on the way out. We were coming out of a narrow channel, and I think the master misjudged the turn in the channel, and we struck the edge of a reef and started taking on water. Again, I was very involved in trying to get that vessel off the reef. We had a cargo of iron, pig iron at the time, and after consultations with the master, we decided we were going to have to dump some of this pig iron on the reef so that we lighten the ship and get off. And we rigged up what is known as a jury rig. It's not an official thing, but it worked for us, whereby we put the ship's gear into use, the derricks and beams, and wire rope, and lifted these piggots of iron out of the hold with the winches and cranes, slung it over the side in a free flow swing. It then had a quick release mechanism whilst it was over the reef that let it go. And this pig iron landed on the reef. We hauled the wires back on board, rewrapped them around some more pig iron, lifted it up, swung it out, and on the outward swing again, the fixed section pulled out, released it all, and let it all fall into the sea. It worked very efficiently. Anyway, we had people who were higher than me examining this, and they praised us for what we did on doing that. And I think my name got a mention. Anyway, to cut a long story short, when we got home at the end of that voyage, I proposed to my wife, and that's when we got married. After that, next best thing that happened to me was I got a call from the London office saying, would I go and relieve someone who was acting chief officer, wanted to go home for his leave, and then he would go back to sea in the same vessel. But would I give him a couple of days' relief so that he could go home, enjoy his Christmas at home, and then go back and join the vessel early in January. So I said, yes, I would do that. However, when I got down to this vessel at Tilbury Docks, I was down there by 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning, sitting having a cup of coffee when one of the office wallers came rushing in and said, you haven't signed your declaration of joining yet, have you? So I said, no, I haven't. We're just having a quiet coffee and a talk about handing the ship over. So I said, well, I've come straight from the London office. They want to see you in the London office. Usually when you get called into the London office, it's for a rap of the knuckles or something that you've done wrong. So he said, I can't tell you. I don't know what it's all about. All I've been told is to stop you signing on this vessel and grab you up. So I went up to the London office with him in his car from Tilbury, up into the higher realms of the office in Berry Street, London. And I was confronted by the senior superintendent, who said, well, you've done long enough as chief officer to know that there's a higher rank. I'm offering you command of a vessel in the early new year. Would you be prepared to take it? So I said, yes, I would. And we discussed pros and cons of that. And then I went home, and it was me that got Christmas at home, and not that poor fellow that was sitting waiting for me to take over from him. And that was the start of my command of 25 years of ships with Bankline. That went on until about 1994.
When you took retirement after more than 40 years at sea.
That's right.
And what were your thoughts at that time? What did you do in retirement?
There was two things. By that time, I had two young children, a boy and a girl, and a wife to consider. And I'd been going away and leaving these people to fend for themselves. The voyages were down to 5 months then. They weren't the two-year voyages that I was doing when I was younger. However, I thought that I should spend more time with my wife and family, and conditions were such that at 57 years of age, I was offered the opportunity to leave on a two-thirds working salary at 57 years of age. Well, they don't come along very often. And on top of that, I would be getting my pension. So I said, yes, I would take that. So they covered me on two-thirds my salary from 57 to 60, when I would have been compulsory taking retirement anyway. I think what I can safely say is my thoughts were with my family at that time. Mm. I wanted to leave. I'd built myself up to giving it up. And I never felt any remorse about it whatsoever. I still don't to this day. I think it was probably the best thing I could do. However, it didn't quite work out that way because I was asked again by the Bankline if I would be kind enough to assist them insofar as when the ships came back to the UK, would I relieve the masters who were there and going back for a week so that they could get a week at home. I would take the ship around the UK coast and near continent. And then they would rejoin again and I could go home and continue my vacation, leave, retirement, call it what you will. And I did that for 3 years. Then, unfortunately, I had a mild heart attack. And that mild heart attack meant that I had to have surgery. I had the surgery and then I could not then be employed because of the fact that I was medically unfit.
Captain Peter Simpson, it's been an honour to talk to you today. Thank you for telling me about what has been a distinguished, unique, and exceptionally interesting career. Thank you.